Welcome to a warm summer evening. Summer must be really upon us. I recently came across an article by a Zen writer named Dale Wright called Secular Buddhism and the Religious Dimension of Enlightenment, where he was exploring what he calls secular Buddhism, a movement maybe most well known through the writings and teachings of Stephen Batchelor, Buddhism Without Beliefs, and so on. It's kind of a movement in America now called secular Buddhism. Not exactly like, we have like mindfulness-based stress reduction that's also closely related to and derived from Buddhist meditation practices, but they wouldn't call that secular Buddhism. It's just a meditation practice. So this is something like going to the original teachings of the Buddha, but kind of paring it down to the most essential and practical elements, taking out the kind of religiosity of it, which might mean like forms and ceremonies, those elements of religion and beliefs based on hearsay instead of direct experience. These would be the things that would drop away in secular Buddhism. And this writer, Dale Wright, also talked about what would a secular sangha be in this kind of case. And I think it's interesting because we have things going on like this in a way. The Insight Santa Cruz is somewhat maybe like secular Buddhism a little bit, in that it doesn't have the rituals and trappings of religion. And it's always, I think, playing with that edge of how traditional and formal to manifest our practice at Zen Center here. So I'm always interested in this discussion and really contemplating what's most beneficial. So the secular sangha, this writer defined as a group of like-minded, self-reliant individuals united by friendship to support each other's flourishing. So something like that. Almost sort of grassroots. Maybe also secular Buddhism could have a somewhat of a non-institutional flavor. Institutions often connected with religion. But if you're going to have a secular sangha, then maybe it has to have some sort of structure, institution. But if it's just also part of secular Buddhism would be veering away from religious hierarchy, which has been part of every religion for ever. And that's where this group of like-minded, self-reliant individuals. And I think that this article quoted, maybe Stephen Batchelor, resonates a lot with Emerson and Thoreau and these kind of American writers that were very into like the self-reliance of the individual. So so then I started thinking about this whole business of teacher and student, right? So that's what I'd like to talk about tonight. What is this business of Zen teachers and so on? Like, for example, if you just have a group of like-minded friends, that the authority is basically the Dharma. This is one view of secular Buddhism, as opposed to a person in authority. And it was compared, the secular Buddhism is compared to the like Protestant Christianity, which I don't know so much about this whole Christian world, but this painted it like that maybe earlier forms of Christianity were had more religious hierarchy, and that the Protestant movement was kind of trying to level that out a little bit, and using, instead of the authority of the church, it was using the authority of the gospel. Does that sound at all like reasonable for Protestant Christianity? And so that's, I think, maybe very similar. Secular Buddhism could use the authority of the Dharma. You know, particularly Stephen Batchelor is, even though he was Tibetan monk for many years, and he was a Korean Zen monk for many years, he now his thing is going back to the early teachings of the Buddha. So maybe it's the type of Buddhism that all the Buddhist schools rely on as the authority, as the early sutras. But then that maybe discounts all of Mahayana Buddhism and the Mahayana sutras and Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. So maybe that's a kind of limited form of Buddhism, but maybe most reliable according to the secular Buddhists. But even if then, if you're relying on the Dharma instead of particular people, then the problem comes up, this article mentions, of, well, who interprets the Dharma? Because the Dharma is not always so straightforward and easy to understand. Right? So there were no particular answers or good way or bad way presented in this article. It was just an exploration of this movement and questioning the potential benefits and pitfalls in this type of approach. So then I could say that there's some, traditionally in Buddhism, there is some role of teachers. And even I think Stephen Batchelor says, well, you need people who've actually like studied and practiced longer to guide a sangha, even with secular Buddhism. But here's some thoughts about spiritual teachers in general. It applies to Zen and Buddhism, but maybe all spiritual practices, and also maybe other things too. And I think one way to look at it is these five types of teachers. And you could say it's this is based on the students, or people looking for teaching. What do they want? I think that's the key thing. These five types of teachers are all available in the world. And what do the students need and want in their life? What are they drawn to? Sometimes it's not even that clear. We just find ourselves in groups and with around teachers, and we make connections, and it's very intuitive. I think it's not something that you can kind of figure out. To some extent, you can kind of decide what kind of thing you're looking for, and I think it's good to ask, what are we looking for in Buddhist practice in general? But sometimes it's much more inconceivable how these things happen. So these five types of teachers are, one would be like basically just a teacher of like knowledge. So maybe in the outside of spirituality, we could say like a university professor. Right? In university, it's not like all the students are just teaching each other. Right? We go to the professors, and we maybe even choose professors based on their knowledge of whatever subject we want to study. And of course, this is true in Buddhism. There's a lot to understand and know of the teachings. I think in Zen, in particular, it's kind of downplayed, because Zen is this so-called special transmission outside the scriptures. So even in classical Zen, they sometimes made fun of the teachers who were just like teaching knowledge and suttas, because there's this more direct kind of thing in Zen. But I think if we're really devoted to Buddhist practice and want to take up the whole thing in an ongoing way, of course we need to learn the teachings. And we can learn them from books and websites and all of that. But inevitably we come up with questions, specific questions about the teachings, and then it's nice to have somebody who's been looking into them a while that can kind of respond from the tradition, almost like a spokesperson from the tradition, because they've looked into it a lot. So that's one, maybe the most basic type. And as I list these five, I think in my own life, I've had all five of these kinds of teachers, sometimes overlapped, but in the same person, for example. But all five of these types of these wishes from teachers, when I reflect on myself, I think I've looked for all these things at different times from different people. I've definitely, I have a very, as those of you know who me know, very conceptual kind of mind. It's a lot of like fire in the mind. It's just like I really want to clarify the teachings and practices in particular in a very careful way. So I think for my Zen teachers in this lifetime, I had to find teachers that were like really into the nuances of the details. So my teacher Tenshin Roshi is, I think, that's one of the myriad reasons why I was drawn to him as a teacher. So a second one is teachers that teach like practical methods of meditation. And this would be like the equivalent in the outside of Buddhism, like say like a yoga teacher. Again, if we really want to learn yoga, we can learn from our friends, but we also go to a certified, trained yoga teacher. This is very different, right, from a college professor teaching Buddhism, right? This is like that you might not learn anything about traditional, the yoga sutras of Patanjali, right? You might. Some yoga teachers maybe get into that, but most, the important part is often learning the techniques and methods. And of course, in meditation, there's myriad techniques and methods. Although, again, if we just look at the Zen tradition, sometimes Zen, besides sort of like making fun of the conceptual sutra teachers, it sometimes maybe even makes fun of the meditation method teachers, because it's so direct. It's like you don't have to do anything. Everything is it. So you don't need those kind of teachers either, maybe, necessarily, in Zen. But, of course, when we start to get into it more, we see there's like 1,000 ways of teaching Zen meditation and understanding what it is. And that I find, anyway, the more I practice it, the more questions come up and the more details I have to clarify, even though our practice is just sitting. We can learn, and of course, in like Sutra Buddhism, the Buddha taught not just one type of meditation, many, many. So third type of meditation teacher would be like helping us applying our understanding and about methods and conceptual teachings to our daily life, to our everyday life. More like the application teachers. And this maybe the equivalent outside of Buddhism would be like a life coach. It's maybe like sort of modern phenomena. Maybe a little bit like a therapist. It's not so much about particular yogic methods. It's not so much about clarifying the nuances of Dharma. It's more just like, I got these issues in my life. What do you think? It's just almost like advice. And that kind of teacher might not necessarily have to know much about the sutras or the meditation methods, depending on what the student's looking for. As I think about these different types of teachers, and what people are looking for, just from my own experience, people coming to talk to me as a so-called Zen teacher, like in Dokusan in particular, and outside of Dokusan, I think that this one so far is often the most popular request. Of course, people in Dokusan ask me about the particularities of methods of meditation and about clarifying the Dharma teachings, but not that often compared to this one. And this has been true, you know, at Tassajara also, and I think it's interesting. And I think maybe it's even part of this kind of secular Buddhist movement, because maybe religious Buddhism is more just like, let's clarify what the religion is teaching, let's clarify the methods of the religion, and like my own kind of life issues are like, once I got the methods and the teachings clarified, I can just apply them. That's maybe a more kind of religious view on it. So it's interesting, and I think when you read the stories of at least the recorded stories of the Zen ancestors, almost none of them are asking just about, how to work out the issues of daily life. Maybe those ones didn't get recorded because they were so ordinary. I'm sure that was asked. And I think that, like, you know, Asian Buddhism, my experience there, practicing in Zen in Japan, was you almost weren't really allowed to ask that kind of question in Dokusan. They had other times when you could kind of informally meet with the teacher. So I think it's nice to just know that we're consciously and sometimes unconsciously, like, the tradition is evolving, naturally does this, right, in a new culture and time and place. So the fourth type of teacher is this is one maybe doesn't have a kind of a secular equivalent. This is the teachers that give precepts and give vows and empowerments and initiations. This is maybe more like in the religious realm, right? And there's not so many. I can't think of equivalents right now outside of in the secular realm. So some students may be looking for this. They've already learned teachings. They already feel like they understand enough the meditation practice. They're already applying the teachings to their life, and they want to, like, make a commitment to the Bodhisattva precepts, for example. Again, all these things can be in combination, but this is something a little different. And you can see how different people might emphasize, different teachers might emphasize these different things. Hopefully, a spiritual teacher can kind of go into all those realms. So kind of making, it's almost like this is more like now more, a little bit getting into the inconceivable. The first three types are more like conceptual practices and knowledge and daily life. This is more like, what is, like, you know, receiving precepts or vows from somebody? What is, like, Abhisheka initiation, where we sprinkle water on the head and one's Buddha nature is immediately opened up and meets the teacher Buddha nature through a deep trust in Buddha nature, for example. That's kind of inconceivable. It's not so secular either. But I think that's where this is now getting into the realm of kind of classical Zen. I've mentioned before, some of you have heard that, like practicing Zen in Japan, of course the teacher would offer Jukai ceremonies, right, giving the precepts. One time there was a ceremony coming up and everyone was invited to participate, and even if they received the precepts, they could do it again. There were some new people. there who hadn't really, kind of new to Buddhism and Zen. And I think I asked one of the senior monks, like, do you have some, you know, English translation of the precepts, since the ceremony is all in Japanese? Like, the students should, it'd be good if they know the precepts they're committing to, right? Because they don't speak Japanese. And the senior monk was like, oh, that doesn't really matter. The main thing is it's this, like, connection with the teacher and this initiation into Buddhahood. So, and the precepts are almost like a kind of a footnote to that, or a little bit of a kind of symbolic, or in Zen, the precepts express that. They're Buddha, we call them Buddha nature precepts in Zen. So, again, in our veering towards secular Buddhism in America, I think many people have never even heard that before. In the Zen world, we just think, of course, it's all about the ethical conduct of the precepts, which I think is very nice that we do emphasize that. But we sometimes de-emphasize the abhisheka part so much that it's just like purifying the room with blessed water or something. So this is the fourth type of teacher. And the fifth is maybe the classic Zen teacher that doesn't need any do any conceptual teaching, doesn't need to do any methods of Zazen, doesn't even need to give any advice or even any initiations, but just points directly to one's true nature, meets Buddha nature to Buddha nature. The utmost simplicity. For example, it could be like, well, whatever's happening right now, like whatever thought or sensation or experience you're having right now, maybe frustration with concentration, with the heat, with the day, maybe happiness, maybe sleepiness, whatever is happening, we just turn around and look at what is aware of this frustrated feeling. What is it that's aware of whatever our experience is right now? Whatever our experience is. Maybe it's like doubt of like, why would somebody talk that way? What's he driving at? So it's kind of this kind of like doubt or confusion, like, what's that mean? So that's the experience that's happening. What is it that's aware of this experience? We don't need any knowledge, any Buddhism for that. We don't need any methods or postures or even concentration for that. It's almost like not doing anything at all. It's definitely not changing our experience into something else. It's just a looking. So that kind of pointing could be another type of teaching that that people might be looking for. And that one, I think, doesn't have many equivalents also in the secular world. Anywhere else, maybe. So it's nice to, I think, we offer Dokusan meetings with teachers here. It's nice to... You might say, well, why would we go do that? It could be one of these five reasons. It could be something else, too, but I think this covers a lot of reasons to... But sometimes we don't even know why. We're just like, I think I'm supposed to, but maybe that's not such a beneficial reason. I'd be like, well, what am I actually... Do I feel completely clear and at ease in my practice? And if not, can I clarify it all through whatever I'm reading? And if not, then can I just discuss it with my friends? And if not, then will it happen through doing some special ceremony? And if not, then what? So nice to ask what we're looking for in general in the practice, and can any guides help us? So traditional thinking about this teacher-student thing a little bit more, some qualities, these are just from the classic teachings, qualities of students are open-mindedness. Often it's like, you know, if you have a full cup and you try to pour something in, it just overflows. So this empty cup is like actually not exactly that we're trust whatever the teacher says, but we're like open to hearing something new. I think if we're not open to hearing something new, then what's the point of even talking with anybody, actually? We're like, so this kind of open-mindedness and not like gullibility and just believing what other people say, but kind of like just hear a new view and try it on. It's kind of like not being too attached to our preconceptions and previous opinions. And we actually want to learn something new. Those are some classic qualities of students. Classic qualities of teachers are they have a good relationship with their teachers. Now, sometimes relationships with teachers are hard. So we have challenges with our teachers. That's, I think, good and appropriate. But if we have a major rift, like which actually happens more than you would think in this world, then it's something to, I think, if we're really getting, you know, wanting to practice kind of long term with a teacher, I think that's something to look out for, because it's like, well, if they couldn't kind of work it out with their teacher, then do I think that they're going to be able to work it out with me? So I think that that's a classic thing to look for. And it's hard because sometimes we have to actually go beyond the teacher in some new way. But basically, a good, respectful and valuable relationship where the student feels like, actually, my teacher is so important to me that I couldn't even have survived without them, maybe. It's kind of how I feel. And also, of course, committed to ethics and compassion and kindness towards others is, of course, important. And have some, another classic one that, again, is points, you know, a little bit at this secular Buddhism thing, is traditionally that the teacher actually knows more than the student. And sometimes we might think, like, of course, this is in all other fields. We assume that, right? Like in school, in university, in yoga, in not necessarily therapy, because that's more like you're working it together. Which, interestingly, since that's, as I said, that's the dominant, this third type of like life coach, if that's the dominant paradigm in the modern Buddhist world, then maybe the teacher actually doesn't need to know so much more. Except they maybe do have more experience applying practice to their life. That's maybe what we're looking for. And hopefully they have a sincere wish to benefit the students and others, and they're not just like trying to get credit for being a teacher, for example. So there's some certain authenticity and humility, and hopefully bodhicitta, like they don't feel like, I've gone far enough in this practice and like, I got it, and what do you want to learn from me? I got it all. Like, bodhicitta is like, there's always deeper to go. There's always like, I'm continuously wishing to practice and unfold the Dharma and awakening in my life, because there's no end to the deepening of that. So hopefully, even if a teacher actually seems like they know the Dharma really well, for me, a traditional quality and I love in teachers is they're actually always studying to learn more. Even though it seems like they've already done a lot, they're like really devoted to continuously deepening. So my teacher, Tenzin Roshi, one time somebody asked him, do you need a teacher in Zen practice? And he said, no, you don't. It's nice. It's very great if you do. Of course, it's a great benefit, but you don't need one. Except for two times when you actually do need one. You need one when you're so discouraged in your practice that you're going to like give it up completely, and you've lost faith in the practice, and you're just going to slowly drift away because it's kind of like, it was good enough and I couldn't do very well anyway, and it's, you know, maybe it's just one of those religious things, right, that people do, and I don't really need that. It's like, that's when you need a teacher. To basically just encourage you, like, it's not a sham. It's real. It's actually, this is, the Buddha's awakening is not just bait on a hook. This is like potential for all humans, right? And, so that's one extreme when you actually need a teacher, and the other extreme is when you think you're totally enlightened. And everything in between those, it's nice to have a teacher, but you don't really need. And it's hard too, because you know, as you get older, teachers die. Of course, our late abbot, Catherine Danis Dyosho, was a teacher for many, many people here, and for many years. So, what a loss. And so maybe if people have been practicing long enough with a teacher, that they at some point, they don't necessarily look for another teacher. Sometimes they say it's nice if you can find that, like all the way till you die. So maybe if you're like 100 years old, maybe you're not gonna find a 150-year-old teacher. In Tibetan tradition, it's this whole rebirth thing, right? So that the really old ones have these really young teachers. It's the incarnation of their old teacher. And I think just to have those connections is something beautiful, right? And many teachers. I think any teacher who says, like, you should only practice with me and you'll get confused if you talk to other teachers, that's a teacher, like, I would not want to practice with. That's too narrow. Because ideally, they want your awakening and happiness, any teacher. So if you feel inclined to practice with somebody else, then a compassionate teacher will be like, if you feel that, then please follow that heart, follow that bodhicitta. There's not like a kind of possessiveness of students. So another interesting topic I think to look at in this realm is comparing Dharma teachers and psychotherapists. Especially if we say that this third type of like the kind of life coach teacher is so much like therapy. I've only done a little bit of therapy in my life, but I find that often Dokusan has that feeling, that flavor, people coming to me, and you know, I'm not trained as a therapist, so sometimes it's it's hard to steer it sometimes back to like, how does the Dharma apply to this point? But I came across one teaching comparing this, like, Buddhist teachers and therapists, the differences. And these are, you know, these aren't hard and fast differences, but something, you know, to think about. Sometimes, anyway, one goes to the therapist with, like, really deeper emotional issues and really just trying to stabilize one's life. And I think you can go to Dharma teachers like that too. But this one teacher was emphasizing that you might, for Dharma teachers, at least traditionally, it was more like you kind of have things basically stable, and then you're going to, you still, it's not like you're free from suffering, because that's the whole point of Dharma teachers, is working together to all become free from suffering. But not too distraught. So sometimes if somebody's really kind of freaking out, like in an ongoing way in the Dokusan realm, then, you know, this would happen at San Francisco Zen Center too. Then it was usually recommended, well, you should maybe at least also do this therapy thing at the same time. Another way to look at it might be like, therapy is more like you're establishing a good, strong sense of conventional self and kind of self-esteem. And then Dharma teachers maybe kind of like pulling that away again. So in that way you could see them. Again, it's not so black and white, but these are different elements. Another difference in these two that has been brought up is therapy is often like about being heard. Like therapist Nettie's Carr says, be seen, be heard. Yeah. And I think that's essential. And also, of course, Dharma teachers come to be heard, but this one person brought up this distinction of like, actually, the traditional coming to the Dharma teachers, you're not so much coming to be heard as to be more like this empty vessel, ready to be filled. You're wanting to learn something or hear something about your practice. So you're more listening. This is, again, not to be taken as definitive difference, because there's, of course, both, in both realms. And another one is that therapy doesn't necessarily get into, like, the ethical realm and your conduct in your daily life. Again, it might, but it might be more like what you're doing, you know, in your daily life is not my business, or, you know, how you treat people. Of course, that might come into therapy, but it might, but in Dharma teaching, of course, we're looking at our whole life and conduct and even commitments and vows. You're talking to the teacher about, you know, ethical commitments and so on, which is maybe not so common in therapy. So then there's this whole thing about this whole personal thing. I heard one teacher say recently that there's no such thing as devotion to a teacher. Not even that you shouldn't be, but there's actually no such thing as devotion to a teacher. In some traditions of Buddhism, there's a lot about teacher devotion, but this was saying that what we call devotion to a teacher is really just attachment, and true spiritual practice is only devotion to truth and Dharma. And of course, it might be like a very close connection with a person, a personal teacher, and it might look like being very devoted to that teacher, but it's actually devoted to the truth, and you're just doing that devotedly with a teacher. That's nice to, I think, pull those apart a little bit, because sometimes it gets so personal towards the person. And I think this was a very strict teaching. I heard that there's no such thing as devotion to a teacher, true devotion, because true devotion to anything is actually just attachment. That's a little bit hard, a little bit intense, but I appreciate it. It's a kind of an ultimate view. So similar to that, we have in Zen, we have these stories like Huang Bo was, who's the one who classically said, all Buddhas and all sentient beings are only this one mind outside of which nothing exists. I love that straightforward quote of Huang Bo. It says it all in one sentence. But he was one of the great Chan masters of old China. And one time he said to the assembly, who was, maybe quoting different teachers like I'm doing now, and he said, you people who just go around looking for quotes from different teachers, you're dreg slurpers. You're slurping the dregs of the ancient teachings. Yeah, that's the residue that's at the bottom of the bottle. the true juice is already gone and you're just slurping at the leftover dregs. Kind of strict. Kind of embarrassing for me to be quoting the ancestors. You people are all dreg slurpers. If you go on seeking Dharma like this, how will you ever have today? Don't you know that in all of China, there are no teachers of Zen? Having today means like this, yourself, here and now. If you're always looking for the words of the ancients. And a monk came forward from the assembly and asked Huang Bo, well then, if you say that there's no Zen teachers, what about all those who are like guiding people and leading Zen temples and so on? And Huang Bo said, I don't say that there's no Zen, it's just that there's no Zen teachers. Which is, I think, very similar to, there's no such thing as devotion to a teacher, but there's devotion to Zen, and it might manifest in what appears to be a teacher. You could say Zen is the Zen ancestors would say, Zen is the Buddha mind school. Sometimes we call it Zen, but it's really the Buddha mind school. So devotion to Zen is devotion to Buddha mind, and Buddha mind manifests as people sometimes. So we can like be devoted to the Buddha mind through a connection with a person, but we remember that it's when we're relating to the person, we're relating to their Buddha nature. Before Huang Bo said that, earlier when he was practicing with his teacher, Baijiang told him, if your view equals your teacher, you have less than half your teacher's virtue. Only when your wisdom goes beyond your teacher are you worthy to pass on the transmission. It's kind of unusual because you might think, well then you think it would be getting, since the time of Buddha, it would be getting better and better. You have to keep surpassing the previous. But we might say that it's going to be, something's going to be fresh and new in a new way. It's got to go beyond the previous generation. And Dogen says, of course, he talks about this a lot, this whole teacher-student shebang. He says, one can tell a true teacher by listening to their teachings, just as one can scoop up water from a stream to find out about its source. False teachers teach people to seek awakening outside of mind. The fault of some Zen teachers is letting students neglect the root and go out on limbs. Go out on the limb. So in Zen, it's always trying to point back to the root, the most basic, like, what is this? Here, now, how will you have today? And Dogen also says, both following a teacher and following a sutra are actually following the self, yourself, your true nature. A sutra is no other than a sutra as the self. a teacher is invariably a teacher as the self. This being so, to visit teachers everywhere is to visit the self everywhere. So it's never really an other, and that's what the direct teaching is saying. We're always meeting ourself. Because when we look for the other, we look in the most direct way, how do we know the other anyway? How do we know the other? What is it that knows the other? And we look back and we see it's just this knowing. The other is no other than the knowing of the other. And this knowing is ourself. So therefore the other is ourself. So I'm thinking about teachers and students. I feel so much gratitude to my own teachers. I love Dharma, so naturally I've had many, many Dharma teachers, some closer than others, but of course listened to teachings, but actually went to talk to and meet many, many teachers and hung out with them in different traditions too. And that's the greatest gift. I love Dharma talks too, but actually going to actually like, that's like, talk about Dharma. What do you think about that and this? And some of them I've dropped away and I'm not in contact with at all anymore. And others I miss dearly and I'm sure I'll find more as my life goes along too. And anyone can actually be a teacher, if we're really open to it. You have any questions or comments, thoughts about this topic? Yes.
I find the term secular Buddhism confusing. It seems to me as soon as one puts Buddhism on it, it's not secular anymore.
Yeah.
We'll just say secular life.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's maybe true. Like, I think Stephen Batchelor's latest book is called After Buddhism. So they're still using this word as a kind of a reference point to maybe get Buddhists to buy the book. and they're referring to the Buddha's teachings, but maybe the ism in particular is doesn't really hold up. The ism kind of goes with the religion in a way. Maybe we'd say like lifeism, secular lifeism, based on Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings. And I think maybe part of the secular thing is especially based on the ones that work for us and not based on the ones that don't. Because that's the maybe part of the problem with religion is that you have to take the whole thing. You don't have to, but it kind of comes along with religion sometimes. But yeah, I think that's right. Secular Buddhism is almost like a contradiction in terms. Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the past, I would have done it.
Yeah.
You know, but there wasn't, so I had to be kind of led into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And this, this is what I'm familiar with.
Yep.
So there's all different points. And the same thing with the idea of teacher, we're talking about teachers, which is a big subject. But for me, I've had all those different kind of teachers, and same teacher sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a good teacher for me has always been one who's been able to respond to me in whatever way was necessary, even to confuse me if necessary.
I
think. Lead teachers because they have expectations and they want to hear.
Mm.
And sometimes that's not what it's best coming in from a teacher.
Yeah.
So
maybe they could even respond to you in all five of those ways.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Rhett was one of the people that really confused me a lot. It pissed me off. And I'd spent 3 months thinking about it and realized, you know, there's no reason why you should be, you know, mad at me or trying to be mean to me. He's probably just helping me. And I started to, you know, figure it out and then come back to him. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not always what you want to hear, it's not always feeling good. So,
mm-hmm.
You know,
yep.
I just want to be heard, yeah.
You know, yeah.
It's been therapy for me too.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes wonder, you know, what am I doing? Because they're Dharma teachers, they're just people like myself.
Mm-hmm.
They're practicing, and they're not necessarily psychologists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's another one is sometimes when we're looking for teachers, some actually, I think, look for teachers who are very much like themselves, because it's less scary. And it's like, It's less hierarchical feeling too. It's more like friendship. I gave a similar talk last night in Monterey about this topic, and somebody there said, who's a long-term practitioner, said she was friends with her teacher, and at some point she wanted to do this teacher thing. Her friend was a Zen teacher, and the Zen teacher said, well, if we're going to do that now, we have to change our relationship, and we can't be friends anymore. I was like, wow. I thought that was interesting, a little bit dramatic story. And she said they even did a ceremony to sever their friendship. I was surprised. But she loves that teacher, and she said it was the greatest thing ever. And our relationship changed, and it was very beautiful. And maybe over time they became more friends again. But I thought that was a dramatic example of how sometimes we look for a sort of peer type thing, and sometimes I was one, especially because I started young, in my early 20s, Buddhism. I wanted a teacher who was not like me. Definitely not like me, you know. And somewhat like me, but who had a lot of qualities that I was aspiring to and wanted to learn from too. So I think it totally depends on the student, what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. I've had since I raised it, like two teachers. I had one I could talk to, you know, I'm talking now. And then there's one where I never could be a friend of. And I like that, because there's a reason. And the reason is because when I went in there to do Vinokasan with them or something like that, I didn't really spend all my time just, you know, yammering, trying to find the problem. It was like, so I had to sort of have a focus. You know, it was very serious. The person's like this. And it came more from more direct.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know until I actually sat down with that person. Mm-hmm. And then something would come up, it would arise. Whereas with the other teacher, which was also great too, but it was more about excavating. It was more about, you know, what's going on with my, you know, daily life.
Yeah. That's a nice example. And both are good, right? At different times. So you can have lots of different teachers. Yeah, both appropriate. Mm-hmm. Yes, Monica.
So I've read someone's perspective that Buddhism is more of a philosophy than a religion. And part of that is that there's no Godhead. And I've always felt really comfortable with that. Because I associate bad things with religion.
I think that's often the American Buddhists often come to it kind of having felt being kind of like burnt by religion in some way.
Right.
So that's, I think, part of why, because it's all kind of convert Buddhism in America, pretty much universal, almost universal.
Right.
So that it's then because of that, very naturally it becomes kind of secularized. Yeah,
At the same time, not to keep the Buddha credit for the teachings is kind of...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is somewhat unique in that many people see Buddhism as a philosophy and not a religion. Maybe some see it just as a religion and not a philosophy. Maybe more like Asian folk Buddhism. They don't even know the teachings of the Buddha, but yeah. But it's very devotional or something. So, and everything in between. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Kokyo. You've set my mind racing in places I didn't know that I would go about teachers. And I think of how I really can't function without them, and there's so many different kinds of them. One of them came to my mind was my dentist. For 30 years, I've known him. I knew him when he was in... just out of dental school, when he had girlfriends, when he got married, when he has children who are now in and out of college, and how much he's taught me over 30 years of how he lives his life. And a particular political people who over the years have just shown me integrity and such good things about what they do and how much they care for this world. Those are my teachers. Those are the people I get up in the morning and think about, not consciously. There's my leader for today, if I read it in the paper. And many members of this Sangha have been my teachers constantly or one at a time over time. I don't think I can do without that. Self-awareness of not having teachers, I don't particularly want to go there. And people I don't like, and people who cause me infinite amount of trouble and grief. At times, I have to say, reluctantly, I just learned something.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, always.
I don't think self-actualization would interest me if or self-awareness was the term, if that meant I didn't really need teachers. I need more teachings. I need teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Dogen, interestingly, right after this point where he says, where Dogen says, this being so, to visit teachers everywhere is to visit the self everywhere, right? So they're just yourself. But then right after that he says, hearing the words self-realization, foolish people think that this is to receive transmission without a teacher and that one only needs to study by oneself. This is a great mistake. So you were maybe channeling Dogen there.
Having read these Zen books and still not understanding
them.
Thank you.
So it's, yeah, there is no other, and we fully reveal, understand, and manifest that through meeting the so-called other as teacher. Yeah. And Dogen also talks about relating to stones, tiles, rocks, and pebbles as teachers too in this way. Because everything is an expression of this nature. Well, it's time to stop. Let me just read a poem to finish. This is W.S. Merwin, who is a contemporary poet, but also a Zen practitioner. I think he's a Rinzai Zen practitioner. And this poem is called Finding a Teacher. In the woods, I came on an old friend fishing, and I asked him a question, and he said, wait. Fish were rising in the deep stream, but his line was not stirring. But I waited. It was a question about the sun, about my two eyes, my ears, my mouth, my heart, the earth with its four seasons, my feet where I was standing, where I was going. It slipped through my hands as though it were water into the river. It flowed under the trees. It sank under holes far away and was gone without me. Then where I stood, night fell. I no longer knew what to ask. I could tell that his line had no hook. I understood that I was to stay and eat with him. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. Kissing them, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.